Although taking part in Morse's program was entirely voluntary, the committee decided his research would intrude on patients' rights. Dr. Morse's verdict was, "I feel that intruding on patients' rights had nothing to do with the decision. The real reason is that doctors don't like to research death. Although most people die in hospital, the subject of death is almost taboo there." The first near-death experience we talked to was Helen, a woman close to 50, whose memory of what happened when she was 8 was as fresh as if it was yesterday. She had been in the local swimming pool, I was in the deep water and I couldn't get back because I was extremely tired. I started to go down and after the second time, my body was so heavy I couldn't get back up. The third time I went down I blacked out. Then I saw myself at the bottom of the pool, and I was going up in the air, and heard the lifeguard yell, "Everybody out!" The next thing I knew, I was on a road and it was a black road. I don't know why, but there was a little deer with me and I was walking on this road. Then I was in this beautiful garden with a gigantic tree and a river. There were children by the tree playing. They wore outfits that reminded me of togas, what they used to wear in Roman times. They saw me and asked me to come in. I tried to go in and I was halfway when I felt a sort of wall or force, I can't explain quite what it was, but the next thing I was being pushed like I was in a vacuum. I was back in my body. Just before I heard the lifeguard ask me if I was all right, an angel said something to me. Since I was only 8, I didn't understand what it meant. But as I got older, it made sense to me. He told me if I led a good life, I had nothing to fear from death. Ever since then, I've tried to do that, but no one's perfect. I said nothing for years, because I was afraid of what people would think, especially my family. I kept it quiet until I heard that other people had had this experience. I think it's the reason I'm not afraid of death, because I know that when I die there's nothing to be afraid of. My parents are both gone now, but I'll probably see them and it will be a joyous occasion. Another middle-aged woman in a suburb of Seattle sat in the lounge of her home and told of 3 out-of-body experiences as a child. She has a reputation for being psychic, which fits in with a survey which showed people who have had a near-death experience are likelier than the rest of us to display psychic ability. This is her story. "It was the first thing I recall in my whole life. It was very vivid. I was just 2 years old and I was trying to climb on top of a very large piece of furniture, a very old-fashioned radio which was twice as tall as I was, and I pulled it down on top of myself. The next thing I knew I was across the room watching myself being repaired in the lap of a man with a dark uniform and a matching dark hat. I was in the same room, but there was sat on the sofa and I was watching the whole proceedings. There was a lot of bright lights around me. Next thing, I was awake again. It wasn't a classic situation where I was pronounced dead, but I'm absolutely certain I was out of my body. I confirmed with my mother years later that the man in the uniform was a fire and rescue man. I never told her until I was 30 years old. She was astonished. What happened was I had a blow on the head and I carry the scar to this day. The next time it happened I was 8 years old. I had scarlet fever and was ill for about 6 weeks. One night in the dark of my bedroom I floated right out of my body. I was aware of myself on the bed, but I floated outside the house through the roof. I suddenly began experiencing an alternating presence of a brilliant light that was enormous, expansive, just filled horizon to horizon and alternated with a feeling of darkness and being closed in. This would go back and forth and I believe was connected with going in and out of my body. That was extremely vivid and I didn't tell anyone about it. I had been extremely ill for several weeks, getting progressively worse. I had a high temperature and I carried this within myself. I knew I had died at that time. My third experience happened some years later when I was 15. I was at the dentist's. We were quite poor, I hadn't been there for years, and it was discovered I had 13 cavities. To help myself feel better about all these fillings, I wore my favorite dress, with hieroglyphics all over it. I was sitting in the chair reading magazines, and the dentist came out, gave me an injection and left the room. I felt my heart completely flip over. It was totally unexpected. It just almost leapt out of my chest and stopped. It was astonishing, like being hit in the chest. The next thing I knew, I was on the ceiling looking straight down upon myself. I saw a chair, a body with long, blonde hair parted in the middle, and I saw the dress, and it clicked. That's mine. How can that be? I'm up here. All there was from my level up was that bright expanse of light. I looked down, starting to wonder what to do next, when I woke up in the chair. I discovered later that I was sensitive to that anesthetic, which can create an allergic reaction, causing adrenaline rush to the heart. Several people die every year not knowing they are allergic to it. To this day, I have to tell the dentist about it in advance or I start going into shock. I'm not afraid of the dentist, but I tell them ahead of time or I might be up there again, looking down. It may seem grotesque, but to me the experience is totally peaceful, a feeling of perfection and completion. There's no struggle. I'm not afraid of dying. There are people who don't want to go, but I feel it's part of the whole living process. Mark, the teenager who nearly died as a baby, was the most startling case we met that day. To claim memories from the age of 9 months is very unusual, even accepting that a near-death experience is something few people seem to forget. We met Mark on a netball court, being coached by his father and shooting baskets with great ease. A well-built youth, Mark helps to make a career in sport. He shows no sign of his years of ill health as a child. Dr. Morse told me Mark was born with a tracheomalacia or floppy windpipe. A tube was inserted into his throat as a temporary measure. At the age of 9 months, he was rushed into hospital. This is Mark's story. I was a tummy sleeper and I was rolled onto my back and my implant in the throat fell out. I had a cardiac arrest. I died and I was gone for about 40 minutes. I went out of body. I remember seeing doctors and nurses and my bed with me in it. There was like a wall that divided my grandfather and my mother from me. They were hugging each other and crying. I could see them but I couldn't get through to go to them. I just remember floating out and I could see my body down below and there was nowhere to go except up into a dark tunnel and I started crawling into the tunnel. It's endless, it's dark and I couldn't see any light. Time had no meaning. I didn't know how long I crawled in the tunnel but after a little while I could see light and I just kept on going. There was like a helping hand as I went up the tunnel. I'd go a little way and I'd fall back a little bit. Eventually, I made it to the top and it got really super bright. I wasn't crawling anymore. I wasn't floating, I wasn't walking. It was like gliding in a way. The first thing I saw was white figures of crowds of people. They didn't have a scary face. I didn't have anybody dead at the time, so I didn't know anybody up there. Then I remember seeing golden roads, and I was wandering around and God appeared and he kind of just telepathically talked to me. All of a sudden we were gliding down the golden roads and I felt better. Then we stopped and somehow he said to me, "Would you like to go back home?" I said no, and he goes, "Well, you have a purpose in life and you need to go back." Then I was back in the hospital and I was in a coma for about 3 months. Today I feel kind of special in a way. Not special compared to anybody else but special because it happened to me. I experienced something a lot of people never experience and I'm not afraid of dying because I know what will happen. I don't want to be stabbed or anything, that kind of scares me. But dying doesn't scare me at all. I first told my parents about this when I was about 5. We were eating lunch. My parents were getting ready to tell me what might happen in hospital where I was going for an operation. They didn't have a chance, because I asked my dad, "Did you know I died?" He said, "Oh really?" And I said, "Yeah, and did you know I ran up and down the golden roads up there?" My dad pointed down the road outside the house. And I said, "No, silly. I ran up though with God in heaven." Eventually, they started believing me. Mark's mother confirmed that singular lunchtime conversation. He was eating his lunch when he told his father he had died and he'd run and run. His dad thought he meant out on the street, but he said no, I was up though with God and I didn't hurt. We were shocked because this child had never been told the extent of what happened to him when he was a baby. He continued to tell us what he saw up there and what had happened to him. The shock was so real because he said to me, you were down the hall and Grandpa was holding you and you were crying. I wanted to come to you but I couldn't. I thought, this child was in a hospital room, way down a hallway from me. I was around a corner and yet he knew what I was doing and who was with me. He had no idea his grandfather was there because his grandparents arrived after he'd gone into surgery and he was in a coma. So it's like he is really telling me the truth because he has seen things he doesn't know happened, things that we had not talked about as a family. He also remembered a time when he had a short cardiac arrest when both of his lungs deflated. He told me later he was out of body. I didn't think he could say those words but he said, Mom, there was a mobile in my room. They were aeroplanes and they went round and round and you and Daddy used to blow them and look at them. And he had never seen the mobile. He was in a coma all that time. No one talked about the mobile to him afterwards, it was something that just wasn't important. An intravenous bottle was connected to his arm because his veins were very bad and they invented this system with paper medicine cups and every nurse had to be very careful. We never told him about this, but when he was telling us his experiences, he told us all about the IV. He didn't know about it because he was unconscious and yet he's telling us what he sees and exactly what happened. He also told us about a little girl in the room beside him when he was in a coma and had an out-of-body experience. We never knew her or met her, but we found she was brought into his room to have her hair washed, and yet he could tell us all about this little girl. Mark's father, listening to this conversation, chimed in. It was spooky. At first I couldn't accept it. He must be making it up or somebody told him a story. Then after he told us a few more things, what could I say except, maybe you're telling the truth. Now, I know too that when I die I can look forward to something in the end. I'm not afraid to die, just like Mark, who doesn't want to die violently but would like to go peacefully. That's just how I feel now. Chapter 11, Vision of the Future. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. The Bible. The spirit of an American GI was taken on a conducted tour of the next world by Jesus Christ. After a review of his own past life, the soldier saw apocalyptic visions of this world's past and future. Trying to return to this life, he began searching an army hospital for his body, which he found when he recognized his fraternity ring on a hand sticking out from a sheet covering an apparently dead man. This was just a part of the most incredible near-death experience I heard in America. Today, the GI is a psychiatrist, Dr. George Ritchie. He told his story, for our benefit, to the eminent parapsychologist Professor Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia, as they sat together at the rear of Ritchie's handsome home on the banks of historic Chesapeake Bay. The full version of Private Ritchie's amazing near-death experience is related in his book Return from Tomorrow. Ritchie regained consciousness on Christmas Eve 1943, and his near-death experience was clearly a religious experience. His visions and the underlying message of love and hope would not be out of place in the Bible. Like so many who have a near-death experience, he glimpsed an idyllic afterworld which changed his life. Like the others we met, he spoke of his experience with passion, even half a century later. George Ritchie's experience began in late December 1943. He was 20 years old and had just finished his basic training at an American army camp, when he collapsed with double pneumonia. Within 24 hours Ritchie had no pulse, respiration or blood pressure and an army doctor certified he was dead. Later, a ward orderly thought he saw the body move and persuaded a doctor to inject adrenaline into Ritchie's heart, which technically saved his life. Probably at the time I was pronounced dead, I sat up on the side of the bed, not liking to acknowledge that I saw something that looked like me lying in the bed. I looked around the room for my uniform. I knew I had missed the train and had to get back to Richmond, Virginia. I couldn't find my uniform, so I went out of the double doors into a connecting corridor. There was a ward boy coming down the corridor and I turned to tell him to watch where he was going because he was about to bump into me. I either went through him or he went through me. As I got outside the door, I suddenly found myself about 500 feet above the ground, going at an incredible speed, heading for what I hoped was Richmond. From up in the air I could see the topography changing. From the trees of western Texas, I crossed various frozen rivers. Then came this city and I saw a civilian walking along the street getting ready to go into this all-night cafe. I thought I'd ask him if I was going in the right direction. When I stopped in front of him, he acted as if he could neither hear nor see me. When I went to tap him lightly on the cheek, I found my hand went right through him. I went to lean against a telegraph post and went through that. Then it suddenly hit me that some radical changes had taken place. I had better consider going back to that hospital in Texas. What could I do in Richmond if nobody could see me? Let me say here that 2 months later, having recovered, I was in a group going from Richmond to see New Orleans, by car, when we crossed the bridge at Vicksburg. I saw this white all-night cafe that I had seen 2 months earlier, and I had never been to Vicksburg in human form before. I think that's important because it takes this out of the realm of being a possible dream or delusion. Anyway, I made a great discovery about that form of traveling I was doing that night. The moment I thought about going back to this station hospital, zoom, I'm going back at a terrific speed. I had no trouble in going back, but I did not know which ward I had been in. I was going from room to room. I could see the nurses, the doctors, the soldiers lying on the bed, but I could not communicate with them because they could neither see nor hear me. Finally, lying there on a bed with a sheet pulled over its head was this body. I recognized it as me by my fraternity ring. I also saw my pale, emaciated hand, the same color as my grandfather's, who I had seen die 3 years before. I was absolutely horrified. My religious background was strict Orthodox Southern Baptist, so my idea of life after death was that when you died you immediately went to either heaven or hell. Nobody told me about this state of suspended animation where you weren't anywhere. And I'm sitting there looking at this body with all the hopes, all the dreams I'd ever had dashed. So I'm sitting there in this state of fear and frustration, when the light at the head of the room kept getting greater and greater in intensity. I found myself virtually propelled up off the bed and the hospital walls disappeared and I saw an entire panoramic view of my life. Seeing my own cesarean section birth, being brought home from the hospital in a shoebox, and everything that had happened to me up to my 20th year. Suddenly out of this light stepped the most amazing being I have ever met, totally different from any of the stained glass pictures of Jesus I have ever seen. One of the most powerfully built beings I have ever seen, and yet he wasn't a TMT in human form. He was in a form that emulated from that terrific, brilliant light, and I could feel the most total love I have ever experienced. We didn't talk as you and I have to, it was pure mental telepathy. The first question he threw at me was, "What have you done with your life?" He meant had I been able to love and accept my fellow human beings, the way he loved and accepted me, and quite obviously the answer was no. So I thought, I'm too young to die, and the thought came back, no one is too young to die. I realized he wasn't asking the questions for his information but to give me the chance to really see my life. Soon after that he told me to stay close to him and the next thing we were again traveling out of the hospital at a terrific speed. We came down in this large city beside a large body of water. Whether it was New York, Chicago, San Francisco, I have no idea. I could see all the bright lights, as when you come down at night in a plane. I could see everything that you and I normally see, but it seemed to me I also saw another realm. On a downtown street, I could see physical beings but I could also see other beings. I could see soldiers, sailors and civilians getting intoxicated. They had an electrical field around them that would open at the top, and these other beings would try to influence them. In another scene, war factories worked three shifts around the clock and I could see the physical beings at the assembly lines and the other beings standing beside them, trying to tell them how to run the factory. But, of course, they could no more hear or see them than the guy in Vicksburg had been able to see me. Suddenly I find myself in a section where they are having people who are dying from all over the place. Some were deciding what's going to happen to them. What impressed me most was seeing the beings who had attempted suicide, trying to make them see how their act had hurt the people who loved them. Then he changed realms again and we were where I wouldn't want to be under any circumstances. I have never been in a room with so much hate, so much animosity, such self-righteousness, such know-it-all. These beings were still trying to bludgeon each other to death or trying to commit some lewd sex act, not out of sexual enjoyment, just out of hate or anger. Even in this room, beings of a higher order were trying to express love and trying to get these beings to change their minds. The next room I call the mental or intellectual room, center of higher learning. I heard some of the most beautiful music I ever heard in my life. I was conducted through a building of laboratories. Now I had majored in chemistry and biology in pre-med school, but I simply could not understand the instruments with which these beings were working. You know, 10 years later, about 1953, I felt the hairs go up on the back of my neck when Life magazine carried a picture of the first atomic lab in 1943, prior to Hiroshima, and there was one of the instruments I saw these beings working with. After that I was taken to a library, bigger than all the downtown buildings of Richmond put together. This I gathered housed all the holy books of the universe. The Christ wasn't at all upset that they were studying the different religions. Now, you can imagine what that did with my background, where if you were Baptist, Methodist or Presbyterian you were saved, Catholics were just about beyond redemption and if you were Jewish you were hopelessly lost. By that time, I really think I have seen everything. Next thing we're traveling out into space itself. I'm not sure to a planet, almost a realm of sheer light. The beings there were more likened to the Christ who was conducting me. This was the first room where the beings could actually see us. These beings were very evolved souls that had learned to love the way Christ had taught us. I was shown natural disasters getting worse and worse, earthquakes and hurricanes. I saw explosions I couldn't comprehend. This was 1943 before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I saw a time when great peace came to the planet. And then he let me know I had to return. I found myself losing consciousness and next thing I remember was opening my physical eyes and seeing the ring on my finger and passing out again, until the morning of 24 December. Video link on Case Chapter 12 Echoes of the Dead. Ghost stories are always listened to and well received in private, but pitilessly disavowed in public. For my own part, ignorant as I am of the way in what the human spirit enters the world and the way in what it goes out of it, I dare not deny the truth of many such narratives. Immanuel Kant. Hospital doctors and nurses in the United States and India said dying patients frequently saw apparitions of dead relatives and friends who had come to take them away to the next world. Mostly, these were not near-death experiences but deathbed experiences of patients who died within 24 hours of telling staff about their unearthly visitors. This testimony, covering almost 1,000 patients in the two countries, is part of the research that goes into thanatology, a new branch of science, named after the Greek word for death, and devoted to the study of death and dying. Apparitions, says the evidence, are seen by healthy people as well as the dying, and much more frequently than we generally imagine. In autumn 1990, a Gallup poll reported that about half the population of Europe, and considerably more in America, believe in some form of life after death, and a large proportion claimed some personal paranormal experience, such as an encounter with an apparition or a ghost. At his company headquarters in Princeton, USA, Dr. George Gallup Jr. gave his view. Incredible things are happening to people's lives. Large numbers not only believe in the paranormal, but many have experienced something themselves. The data is really quite stunning and comparable in the different countries. It's a phenomenon that hasn't been properly explored. If this century has been devoted to the exploration of outer space, then the next will be devoted to the exploration of inner space. Other surveys, aside from Gallup, have shown that apparitions in the West are very different to the traditional ghost story images of clanking chains, a chill presence, and grey ladies flitting about in ivy-covered mansions. Ghosts aren't the prerogative of the aristocracy anymore, a status symbol to go with the castle. Nowadays, apparitions are frequently seen by ordinary people in everyday surroundings. For instance, widows and widowers in a country parish in Mid Wales were asked in 1971 if they had been contacted by their dead partners. Astonishingly, almost half said they had. Dr. W. Dewey Rees published his findings in the British Medical Journal. For the hallucinations of widowhood, he questioned almost 300 people, or 81% of all widows and widowers in the parish. He was concerned only with waking experiences. He did not include dreams or anyone who had seen an apparition in their mind's eye. Anyone uncertain if they had been contacted was also left out. The survey showed widows who had been happily married were most likely to have had encounters with their dead husbands. There were even 15 people who felt their dead spouse was always with them. Rees said these hallucinations should be regarded as a normal part of widowhood. This means half of all widows can expect a visit from their dead husbands. He also discovered why most of us never realized widows and widowers lead such an active spiritual life. It's because they don't talk about it. None of the widows interviewed had ever told her doctor, and only one had told a clergyman. The reasons for their secrecy were almost unanimous: a fear of being ridiculed, which seems an indictment of the attitude of physicians and priests, and perhaps of the rest of us too. Three other surveys since 1971, using large national samples, confirmed Rees's statistic that one widow in two believes she has been contacted by her dead husband. Most will feel his presence, one in seven will actually see him, a good many will hear his voice, and a few will even have a conversation. Some will feel themselves physically touched. But did these contacts really happen, or were they imagined by lonely and bereaved people projecting their need to be comforted? The answer could vary from case to case, but a caution for those who assume these are hallucinations caused by grief, is that those widows apparently grieving the most, the ones being treated for depression, were least troubled by apparitions. Similar doubts were raised about the apparitions appearing to the dying in hospitals. As with near-death experiences, the question was whether these are the fantasies of a stressed and dying mind or some sign of a dimension beyond death. Parapsychologists Dr. Carlos Ozis and Professor Erlander Haraldson published their findings at the hour of death in 1979, after 15 years of research. Their parallel surveys in hospitals in India and the United States found the same phenomena in each country: apparitions of human figures, usually a dead near relative, came to take away the dying patients. This happened to 591 of a total of 877 patients, divided almost equally between American and Indian hospitals. Drugs were ruled out as a possible cause of hallucinations. Compared to known statistics for apparitions seen by the ordinary British public, the dying seem three times more likely than the rest of us to see an apparition. In the hospital survey, there were some differences between the United States and India. Dying Americans were much more likely to have a woman come to collect them, perhaps a deceased mother. In India, a male-dominated society, men usually came to take away dying patients. Minor religious figures were sometimes seen, but a person's religious beliefs did not seem the cause of these apparitions. In fact, a dozen patients who did not believe in life after death saw apparitions which came to take them away. Patients who saw apparitions changed visibly. Dying is a gloomy and sometimes painful experience, but the vast majority, 72% of those visited by an apparition, became elated and were very willing to go. Naturally, not everyone wanted to make the trip, and a few screamed for help. More Indian patients than American were reluctant to accompany their spectral visitors. Only one American said he was not ready to go to the next world. It was this overall acceptance that Dr. Ozis found so remarkable. He told me, doctors and nurses said the patients were mostly not disturbed by the apparitions, but would light up with expectation.